From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A bee, a wasp, a fire ant, it doesn't want to sting you. A lot of these creatures will try other things first. They'll flip upside down, make loud noises, discharge terrible odors. If they have to, they have to. But when they sting, it's the last resort, because as in all of nature, there's this risk involved, and creatures do this cost-benefit analysis. The cost to us is pain. A sting hurts. Some hurt a lot, like the warrior wasp. Here's how the entomologist Justin Schmidt describes the pain of being stung by a warrior wasp. Torture. You're chained in the flow of an active volcano. And Schmidt knows how this feels because he goes around getting himself intentionally stung. And he's written a book about his work and his observations. Today in the program, he's joining us. We hope you will too, after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The entomologist Justin Schmidt says when you get stung by something, a wasp, an ant, a bee, there's something really complicated going on. A sting is sending a message, a powerful and memorable message. And if you really think about it, you, a large and powerful human being up against a tiny insect, it's kind of silly. Yes, in some cases, stings can be dangerous, even fatal. But Schmidt says mostly what's going on is the wasp or the ant is playing an intimidation game. In fact, he calls it psychological warfare. And they usually win. We run away from the hive or the anthill. And what's interesting about that is this symbiotic nature of that relationship. We, he says, evolved together. These bugs are the way they are because of the way we have reacted to them over time. And who would have thought? Stings are so interesting. Today in the program, Justin Schmidt is joining us to talk about his book. It's called The Sting of the Wild, the story of the man who got stung for science. He actually did this. Justin Schmidt is a biologist at the Southwestern Biological Institute. He's associated with the Department of Entomology at the University of Arizona, and he's joining us today from the studios of Arizona Public Media in Tucson. Justin Schmidt, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Doug.
Okay, I want to start with, let's back into this a little bit and start with your first sting. You're pretty young. It was a bumblebee, I guess.
Yeah, the first sting that I actually got was a bumblebee. If we back up even a little bit further, about, well, 3 months, but when you're 5 years old, 3 months is a long time.
Yeah.
And I was dared by some of the bigger kids. You know, when you're the littlest kid, you have to show, you know, you're worthy of being part of the group. So I was dared to sit on an ant colony. Now, this was in the Northeast, and the ants there bite. They don't sting. So that was at least a plus. And I sat down in this colony, and you can well imagine the ants were not delighted with this. So up my pants they went, and oops, well, you can kind of guess what happened there. Down came the pants, a lot of brushing and a lot of embarrassment. But yeah, I survived the ordeal and then moved on. I guess you'd say I didn't really learn my lesson, because then the bumblebees was the next episode about 3 months later.
At what point, we should talk about this other experience that you have. This is later on. You're doing some work. You're at the University of Georgia, I think, at this point, and you're doing some work in the Appalachian Mountains. This is in rural Pennsylvania. And you got stung, or is it bitten or stung by this ant? How do you describe that?
Well, the ants that, when I was 5 years old, they actually bite. They're kind of interesting. They're what we call formicine ants, which means formic acid. And formic acid is kind of like vinegar, except a lot more toxic.
Yeah.
And that's a marvelous defense that many insects will use. So what they do is they bite you, and if you have tender enough skin, they can actually break the surface. And then they curl around the tip of their abdomen and spray this concentrated formic acid up to 50% formic acid, which is really strong. And they spray that into you. So it feels like a sting because of the burning of the acid.
But then at the Appalachian Mountains where you are, you got stung by an ant. And you said this was nothing like any of the stings that you had before. This was a harvester ant. Talk about that experience, because this was different.
Yeah, exactly. I'd grown up in kind of the northern Appalachians, and we had bumblebees, and we had yellow jackets, and we had paper wasps, and we had sweat bees and honeybees, and, you know, the whole variety of bees. They all seemed, you know, interesting creatures. Then I went down to Georgia, which is at the very southern end of the Appalachians, and there we have harvester ants. And these are big, in this case, red ants, and they make kind of mounds. And what they do is they collect seeds. That's why they're called harvester ants. And they go out and they forage and collect seeds, and they store them in larders underneath the ground in their nests. Very passive sort of things. But for some peculiar reason, they do sting. They don't bite. They sting. And I was trying to look at the chemistry of, you know, what their venom was. It had been reported years before that they were different. So I'm digging these things up, and, well, sooner or later you make a mistake. You're taking a shovel and shoveling ant hails into a bucket. Pretty soon one of them's going to get away and get you. And it's, wow, holy cats, what happened here? I mean, this thing was, I was used to when you get stung by, say, a honeybee or a yellow jacket, which most people sooner or later in their life will have the misfortune of being stung by. And it kind of burns. It kind of reminds me of, you know, kind of a match head breaking off one of these strike anywhere matches when you're trying to light the campfire and landing on your hand, say.
Yeah.
And it's kind of this burning pain. And we don't like it, but, you know, we're familiar with it. Well, this one was kind of sneaky. It started out very slowly, and then it started getting this piercing and then this throbbing. And it wasn't immediate like burning. It was more of a deep pain. It sort of felt almost as if it was reaching under your skin and grabbing at your tendons and your muscles and your nerves, you know, under your skin. And you'd say, well, that's bad enough, which, of course, it is.
Yeah.
But the problem is it went along for about 4 hours. And so that's what got me kind of started on what's going on here. You know, why is this so different? What's it doing? Why is the ant doing it? And you know, what's the chemistry behind it?
So that was the first time that you really started thinking, I'm going to kind of look into this.
Yeah, that was exactly right. Before I just thought, I'd been a chemist before, and so I thought, well, now I'm an entomologist. You know, what do you do with chemistry when you're an entomologist? And at the time, the field was just opening up for chemical ecology, which is the communication between different insects. And more or less like we will speak and that sort of thing. They often communicate by chemistry. So I was working on that. And at the same time, we ran into these ants. And I said, well, the venom is chemistry. Let's work on that.
Yeah.
So that's what really got me started on. I had, you know, no recollection of or any thoughts at all before that of, oh, let's work on venoms.
It's right.
Just one of these things that kind of drops in your lap and you say, hey, this is really cool.
So it's interesting, though, you tell this really great story that I wanted to ask you about of your fascination with science. And you had read this, something written by this famous French entomologist, Jean-Henri Fabre, who asks this question when he was really young. He was like 5 years old. He asked the question, how do I see? What is it about that question that interests you, and how does that help explain your own interest in science?
I think Fabre was very astute in that he realized that you can't just take for faith or a word of, you know, what's happening. There's ways you can actually verify it. And so at 5 years old, he realized that, you know, oh, if I see, how do I see? Well, there's a couple of different choices. You can see with your mouth or you can see with your eyes. And he thought, well, let's see, I'll close my eyes and I'll open my mouth. And he opened his mouth and he didn't see anything. So he said, ah, okay, now let's close my mouth and open my eyes. And then he could see. Now, as absolutely trivial and simple as this seems, that's really the basis of science, that's what science is. You experimentally determine what the facts are. Now, I realize this is completely ridiculous in many respects, but it shows the principle, and that's what we do throughout all of science, that we try to design tests that can distinguish what's really happening from other things that that may be masking, you know, what's happening or sending us down the wrong path.
Okay, so before we get to particular creatures, I wanted to explore some of the things that you work through in the book. And first is this sort of symbiotic co-evolution that we've had with these creatures. Early on, you make this point that we carried, you know, genes of the lessons that we've learned from our encounters with dangerous creatures, you know, from our prehistoric past. But it's interesting you say at the youngest stage of life, you talk about how for kids, fear is kind of muted, that children are, you say, naturally inclined to explore. You say this, you say, children are born naturalists. But over time, that kind of natural talent is driven out of them. Would you talk a little bit about this? Because this seems to really interest you.
Yeah, I think what's going on there is when our ancestors were kind of hunter-gatherers, and that's where much of our culture originated. And, of course, the very young babies that were nursing still would be with their mama out in the field digging tubers or, you know, whatever they're doing, collecting food. But then once they got beyond that wean stage, they would be sitting around in a community with some of the older, usually older women who were no longer having children. And they learned to socialize and all. Part of that socializing was exploring. Of course, they were in a very safe place because they were in their camp and they had adults that were looking after them and this sort of thing. So the adults realized that curiosity and observation are key to survival, especially in adulthood. So they would encourage the children to poke around and they can look at the ant or follow the grasshopper or you know, look at, listen to the birds and learn various things. And they just sort of explore. And, you know, once in a while, if they pick up a big beetle, it might bite them. Well, then they kind of learn, well, you have to look before you leap. You know, look at, it's got those jaws there. And so, but that's all very good learning for the kids. And I think that kind of changes when we get to kind of the universal age of people. It's really strange. And when you get to be about six, that's when we start public schools, and that's when kids start getting out of this small group and starting to go with, you know, older boys or young men and learning the skills of the men or learning the skills of the women. And that's when the time comes when you start training. Well, now you can't be a freewheeling individual. Now you've got to start to learn to be practical, be useful, you know, do things that are going to get us all fed and keep us safe. And that's, I think, when we start driving out that curiosity and saying, you know, well, that's a snake. You got to stay away from it. Don't be curious. You might get bitten.
Yeah.
Which in Africa, of course, is a very wise idea. There's an awful lot of really poisonous snakes in Africa. And so that's where they get the scientific curiosity kind of, should I say, reined in.
Yeah. Are we back to that idea that the genes we carry have the sort of warn us of things? Are we naturally afraid of wasps or hornets, for example, or certain types of ants in the same way we are of snakes? Do we have the same?
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. The human primordial fear is anything that directly attacks us, and it, you know, just the fact that it's attacking us indicates there's some risk. And so, if, you know, obviously if a lion is attacking you, there's serious risk.
Yeah.
Or if a Cape buffalo is charging at you, there's serious risk. Or, you know, a snake is there, it's serious risk. But even littler things, you know, they're still attacking you. And we have this automatic recoiling from that. And I think that's one of the reasons that many animals, when they're cornered, you know, much smaller things, you know, even things as small as a rabbit or such, if you get it cornered, it'll start trying to charge or fight back. And I think that's, again, playing on our natural reaction that, oh, this thing might be able to hurt me, so I'd better, you know, back off. And it often works, and it certainly does in the case of insects.
Yeah. Earlier on, you mentioned the story of a cow killer, also known as the velvet ant, and how this sting is pretty bad, and this truth, you say, is communicated. Let's talk about the velvet ant, or the cow killer, or the mule killer, it's sometimes known as. How bad is this sucker, this sting,
well,
this guy?
Yeah, the cow killer is the really large velvet ant. It's a big group of about 6,000-7,000 species worldwide, and they're distinguished by looking like ants in the case of the female. So they're very furry. They're actually quite cute. You know, many of them have red patterns and orange and yellow and black, and sometimes they have browns and bronzes and silver. They're actually quite gorgeous when you look at them up close. That being said, they have a stinger that's kind of like, you know, Grandpa's old watch that he used to have in his pocket, and it kind of had this watch spring that was coiled around, and it kept the time going. And they're coiled around, the sting is coiled around in the abdomen, so it's actually much longer than you would think. It's almost half the length of the velvet ant. So that means you combine that with you picking it up, and you're going to get stung. And they have a very mobile sting. They can aim it in any direction, almost kind of like, you know, if we have a sword and we're trying to stab something, it doesn't just come out in one direction. We can aim it in different directions, and they can do the same with their stinger. So they have a very effective device, and if you pick them up, they do sting you, and it's this immediate burning, rashy, kind of intense pain that seems like almost a combination of stinging nettles. If you've ever been around a creek side and you've gone into a nettle patch, ouch! You know, these things are really rashy and they itch and they burn. And that's the kind of pain that it does, except a lot worse than common nettles. And it'll last sometimes, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. And some people, it actually will last a lot longer. There's individual variation, and I guess I'm fortunate in my case, it usually goes away about 10 minutes.
From your pain scale, you write, here's the description for the velvet ant. Explosive and long-lasting, you sound insane as you scream. Hot oil from the deep fryer spilling over your entire head.
Yeah, that's pretty much what your reaction is when you get one of the really big ones that I tell a story of my poor student helper that I had who was being very loyal and helpful. And after his exams on some Friday, he decided to come in the evening and take care of the culture of the velvet ants.
Yeah.
And he ended up, I don't know what exactly, I wasn't there, but he ended up getting stung, probably tried to pick one up or move it around. And he ended up in the campus infirmary. And he was in a complete state of panic. And the poor nurses that were there had no idea what to do, and so they called me up, and I said, "Oh, it's the bark is much bigger than the bite. It'll go away. Just a little bit of tender, loving care, and reassure them that it won't do any damage, and it'll pass. Just kind of chill out for a while, and it'll go away. You'll be fine. You'll be just none the worse tomorrow morning." And so finally, it was, but he was in this absolute state of panic because the things hurt so much. You know, you don't know, you've never been stung by anything like this, and you don't know how to react to it. You know, it's just one of these things that, you know, the velvet ant obviously won the psychological war there, that its idea was that I have a tough life out here. My job is hard enough without some big monster coming along and harassing me. And so it'll defend itself quite vigorously if you try to, you know, pick it up or hurt it in any way.
Yeah. Here's a question that comes from James, who writes from Salt Lake City. He says, my wife is radically allergic to bug stings, and she's convinced bees and wasps are out there to get her, and she freaks out when they start buzzing around here. It's my experience, he says, that the more stressed out you act, the more agitated the bug gets. So sometimes I have wasps crawling on me as I watch them, waiting for them to move along, which they eventually do. Can you help me, James says, with this marital argument? Is James right?
James is completely right. You know, he's very astute there. And sorry, I don't want to, you know, get him into trouble with his wife, and don't want to get her mad at me. But yeah, he's right that one of the cues that stinging insects use that they need to defend themselves is flapping. I mean, face it, if somebody is flapping and charging and being very vigorous, aren't they more frightening if they're just placidly sitting there, you know, not doing anything?
Yeah.
So obviously it's psychological that when he has a wasp on him, which I do the same thing. I'll lift them out of a swimming pool and put them on the side so that they, you know, don't drown. And they're not really defensive at all. But if you start flailing and flapping around, especially if you have fluffy hair, then they might get stuck in your hair. And then, oh, my goodness, all bets are off because the thing starts buzzing ferociously. And it's trying to get out. It's now in a panic mode because it's stuck. And it's, you know, something like a spider web or, you know, something that's going to eat it. So it's really quite frightened and quite defensive. So it's buzzing fiercely trying to warn you, hey, you know, I sting. You know, let me alone. Get me out of here. And then if you start flailing around even more, sooner or later, it'll get down to where your scalp is. It seems, I don't know, it's this amazing thing. You'd think 50% chance or more that it would go and get out of your hair, but it almost seems like it somehow or other gets down deeper and then stings you in your scalp, and then you're even more panicky. And so he's completely right. I tell people if you are around any kind of a stinging insect, just stop moving, except you can move your eyes because you want to see where it is and where you want to go to, you know, kind of gently depart the area, which is usually a good idea. And so don't move anything else. And I recommend holding your breath, too, because that's one of the cues that they sense that, oh, there's some big, fierce animal here that might be thinking of me as dinner. And you don't want them to think that they think you're dinner because then they're going to be defensive.
Justin Schmidt is with us. His book is The Sting of the Wild. When we get back from a break, we'll talk about how the stinger works. Thanks very much, James, for that note. We'll take more when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about getting stung. And everyone has, for the most part, been stung at one point or another. The entomologist Justin Schmidt has been stung a lot. He's joining us today to talk about his professional goal of cataloging the painful effects of stings. And to test all of this, sometimes he uses his own body. Part of the discussion today is what it feels like to be stung, but he also explains how a stinger works, how it evolved. The book is called The Sting of the Wild, the story of the man who got stung for science. He's joining us from a studio in Tucson, Arizona. Okay, so you write this. You say that if a stinging insect could speak, the first words that she might shout is, "Who is at my door?" Explain that.
Yeah, this is basically a stinging insect has the problem that particularly if they're social, like a nest of honeybees or yellow jackets or wasps, they're not just defending themselves, but they're defending a whole bunch of their sisters and brothers and the little babies and the queen mother. And the problem is that if you have a whole lot of things, it's kind of, I draw the analogy that if you're at a party and there's a bowl of cashews, you're willing to probably walk 10 feet to get a handful of cashews. But if you see one cashew there, you say, it's not worth the effort to go and walk over and get it. It's the same principle with social insects, that there's a whole bunch of them. There's a lot of, you know, kind of interest in, wow, this will make a nice snack. Whereas one of them, you know, it's hardly worth the effort. It takes more effort to go get the thing than I'll get as nutrition out of it. And so as a result, when something is near the nest, the individuals who are, there's special guards in most cases that they're more alert and they're paying attention to, you know, who's in the neighborhood. And they would want to know, you know, who are you? Are you somebody who's dangerous to me or is it just kind of a false alarm? And so they would want to yell out kind of much like you would if you hear a strange noise in your house. At least I often say, you know, who's that? Or something like that. You know, maybe my son has gotten in a little later from the party and want to make sure that it's my son and not a burglar or something of, you know, that sort. And I think it's the same kind of idea that they would want to know, is this friend or foe?
So they do threats first. You mentioned some of the visual cues, like they raise their bodies and they flip upside down or they flutter. Some make noise, which is really interesting. Some create these interesting odors as well. But so the sting itself is kind of the last resort, I guess. That's the last thing.
Exactly. And again, you could do the human analogy that if some intruder's in your house, you know, the last thing you want to do is shoot them, you know, or at least in my mind, that's the last thing I wanted. I'd rather just have the person, hey, this house is inhabited. Go away. Get out of here. Leave me alone. We don't want any trouble. And so you do all kinds of warning. You know, turn on lights or bang doors or lock doors or, you know, just hope that, you know, whoever's in there kind of gets the hint that, you know, hey, this is not a good place to be. And no free lunch here, folks. So, you know, just get out of here. And it would be the same kind of thing with the insect. They realize if you get in an altercation with something else, chances are you'll get hurt too. You know, if you're in the analogy I was mentioning, if somebody's in their house, they may have a gun too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, who's going to get shot, you or him? Well, you'd rather just have him leave, take his gun and get out of there, or her gun and get out of there. And rather than having to actually risk life and limb. And the stinging insects, it's the same way. It's a risky behavior to go and sting. You could get squashed. You could get bitten in half by sharp teeth or stepped on. You know, it's just not something they really want to take casually.
Yeah. Take us through a little bit the evolution of the stinger, because you write about this in the book. It's interesting. Like, the stinger began as the tube for laying eggs, and eventually it kind of evolves or changes. Take us through that.
Yeah, the stinging insects started out as their ancestors were similar to what we call sawflies today. And sawflies have this long kind of the saw, sort of tells you the name of, they have this egg-laying tube, or ovipositor is the technical term for an egg-laying tube. And they would saw into wood or stems or things so they could lay their egg deep inside. And it's protected from the heat and the light and things that might eat the egg and keeps the moisture better. And so then that's a hard life, though. And from that evolved some insects that rather than just, you know, working on chewing wood and tough plant material, evolved a way to lay the egg in something else, like a sawfly larva that had already done all the work of turning the wood into nice, yummy, delicious tissue, you know, animal meat. Mm. And so you could lay the egg inside that sawfly larva. This would be a parasitic wasp or something of that nature. And then it could feed on that. And so first the stinger was an egg-laying tube. Then it became an egg-laying tube into another insect. But along with that came the realization that, oh, you can be a more effective sting if you paralyze or inactivate or somehow or other physiologically change the host so it can't fight back against, you know, your egg and the larva that's you laid inside it. And so that was the beginnings of the venom that was used just for being a parasitic insect. Then from that stage, it went to what we call the aculeate, another kind of technical term, which means the true stinging ants, wasps, and bees. And at this point, they lost the function of the egg-laying tube for laying eggs. Mm-hmm. So now it comes out of the base of the sting shaft itself is where the egg comes out, and that liberated the whole stinger to all kinds of fascinating new roles, mainly which were producing venom.
Let's talk about venom. It's the only reason a sting is effective, I guess. What is it? Describe this, because this is one of the things that you've been exploring, is sort of the various toxicities of venoms. Are all venoms toxic for insects?
No, that's an interesting point that many venoms are not particularly toxic. For example, the cow killer that we were talking about earlier, oh, it's marginally toxic. I mean, if you put enough of it, and if you blow up, you know, its target with fill it full of venom 10 or 20 times more than could ever be delivered by a velvet ant, you might get some toxicity. So it's actually pretty low toxicity. But what it does is it's extremely painful.
Yeah.
And then another one that's again, not toxic to us, emphasis on us, are the spider wasps, in particular the tarantula hawks, because they sting us and, oh, my goodness, that really, really, really hurts. But it turns out they're almost essentially non-toxic to us. Now, on the other hand, you don't want to be a spider like a tarantula. Because you get stung by that. I don't know if you'd use the word toxic. I mean, you might be splitting hairs, but it's totally paralytic.
Yeah.
And so you could say, well, if I'm completely immobile and paralyzed, is that toxic? And I might argue, well, it's about the same thing because you're going to become dinner for the wasp's baby.
Right. So the more intense the sting, the less toxic the venom? Is that generally work out that way?
No, it's kind of actually more the opposite. Those are the two exceptions.
I see.
And the exceptions actually sometimes make interesting stories because you ask, why are they exceptions?
Yeah.
And it turns out that there's no real need in either the velvet ant or the tarantula hawk, both of which are solitary. It's just the female wasp, and she's just doing her thing, taking care of, you know, one baby at a time, making a cell and getting food for it and laying the egg. And then she abandons it. It's off on its own. You know, does all the rest of the development on her own. So she doesn't have, you know, much other than her own personal self to defend. While there's no real point in doing damage, which is a long-term kind of learning thing. I don't know, most of the listeners have probably sooner or later gotten some bad tainted food, you know, maybe at a picnic, you ate a hot dog that had been out too long and you kind of got a real stomach upset. You kind of notice after that you get this aversion to right. to whatever made you sick and you just smell it. You don't want to get anywhere near it for a while. And that's the toxicity effect. And that's very useful for something like a social insect because, you know, say a pain can be kind of a faking it. You get stung by a honeybee, well, you know, it hurts and you don't like it. But if I can get a tummy full of nice, delicious honey, wow, what's one little sting? So I can say, oh, well, that's well worth the pain.
Yeah.
But if you get a whole bunch of stings and you start feeling, oh, my goodness, I'm really in pain and I'm swelling up and, you know, maybe I'm going into some kind of shock or, you know, something like that, then you say, oh, that toxicity makes it so I don't think I really want to go for that tummy full of honey. I think that's a little too high a price yeah. to pay.
While you're talking about the tarantula hawk, I wanted to have you say something about what it feels like or might be feel like to get stung by one of these. This is one of the worst. This is on a 4 on your pain index. And the advice that you give people who have been stung by a tarantula hawk is to lie down and scream. Talk about what it might be like to get stung by one of these guys.
Yeah, tarantula hawks are one of the most fascinating. They're, of course, the biggest of the spider wasps. It's one of these stories that you are what you eat. And so if you as a larva, the immature wasp, ate a really big spider, you become a really big wasp.
Right.
And so they eat the biggest spiders, tarantulas, so they get really big. So naturally, we're interested in big things. And so entomologists are the main people who get stung by them, because they're actually hard to catch and they're not real common. So once you get one in your net, you have this huge wasp, this gorgeous wasp in your net, and you're struggling trying to get it out of the net and into a jar. And you don't want to lose it, of course, because you might not get one again. And so you're really trying to, you know, deal with this thing, which is very strong, very long-legged, and very long stinger. It's got about a third of an inch long stinger. So
wow.
That's a pretty substantial, you know, it's almost as long as an insulin needle for anybody who's, you know, seen people that have to give themselves insulin. It's about the size of an insulin needle. And this thing, of course, will go through the insect net. So sooner or later, as you're struggling trying to get this thing into usually an undersized jar or container, because most insects are small, so you're not equipped with something really big for, you know, a big gangly wasp. And what happens is it ends up stinging you. And it's just absolutely electrifying. It's amazing. I kind of draw the analogy of having a windstorm snap off a 20,000-volt power line, have that fall down and land on you. Now, of course, I've never had that happen to me. I certainly don't want it to happen to me. But, you know, if you use your imagination for a moment, that's kind of what it feels like. It's just absolutely electrifying, debilitating, incapacitating. And about all you can do is, as I say, lay down and scream. And you would say, wow, that's not really a very scientific explanation. And I actually argue to the contrary that it is scientific advice, because number one, you remember it. Yeah. So then you take the right action if you get stung. But number two is that it's important that while you're incapacitated, you could actually harm yourself by wandering around and trip over a stump or a rock or something like that and fall into a cactus or a fence or, you know, injure yourself, hit your head on a rock. And so if you lay down, now you're as low as you can get. You can't fall any lower than laying down. At least I don't know how you can. And so you can't injure yourself. And scream, well, why not? You know, literally, you think about it, you know, screaming, when you're busy screaming, you're devoting a whole lot of your energy and emotions to the screaming.
Yeah.
Well, screaming doesn't hurt. You know, you never really think about that, but screaming is not painful. It's just something you do, whereas the sting is painful. So if you're screaming, you're distracting your mind from all that pain, which is just so intense. And by the time you've run out of lung power, you know, a minute or two, 3 minutes later, that's odd.
Yeah.
The pain is gone.
Yeah.
And if you look at, you know, you'd say, well, why is the pain so ephemeral, so short-lived? And you look at it from the wasp's point of view, that's one of the things I try to do throughout the book, is look through the eyes of the wasp and the selection forces that would operate on the wasp throughout its, you know, evolutionary history. And the wasp's only goal is to get you to open your mouth or open your hand that's grabbing whatever is holding and restraining. Open it up and I'll fly away, thank you. Mm-hmm. And what's it take? It takes a second to do that. So there's no real need to have the pain last, you know, forever and ever. You know, you're out of there with a lightning flash, and as soon as the mouth or hand is opened, you're gone. So there's no real need, there's no real selection for a long-lasting pain. And so that's you know, why I think it is so short, which is good for us, too.
Yeah, yeah. Here's a question from Gerald, who asks, he wants you to talk about the Asian hornet. I'm not sure which particular one he has in mind. You do write about the giant Mandarin hornet. I think these are in Japan in particular. Their story is really interesting. They're pretty powerful, but the honeybees that they go after have their own sort of defense. Would you talk about this?
That's a fascinating story of an evolutionary arms race going on, that the hornet is massive. It's probably 100, 200 times heavier than the honeybee. They're called the Japanese hive bee or the Eastern hive bee, as opposed to our honeybees, which we call the Western hive bee. Mm. And they're smaller than ours. They're about half the size of our honeybees. And they were being predated by the hornets. You can imagine something that's armor-plated with jaws that are bigger than your entire body, and they can just simply crush you and dispatch you at a rate of 20 or 30 a minute, you know, just every couple of seconds they just smash a bee. And what they're doing is they're trying to take over the colony of the honeybees so that they can eat all their young larvae, their brood, and some of the honey. They're more interested actually in the brood, because that's what they need to feed, you know, the wasp young. And so it's a rather lopsided battle. And during the evolutionary history, it turned out that those honeybees, Japanese honeybees, that had a different strategy from the ordinary rather than just frontal assault and, you know, going out there and attacking, you're just getting smashed and destroyed, that they would pull back, kind of clever thought, pull back into your hive. But you don't let down your guard. You pick up your attention. You mass hundreds of you there at the entrance. And when you finally, the hornet gets kind of brash and brave after a while and says, I can't, you know, get anywhere. So it comes in and then you all jump it. It's kind of like having 500 six-year-olds jump, you know, a great big strong man. You know, they pretty soon are pulling on your hair and your mustache, if you have one, or your beard, and every finger and toe and, you know, any part of your anatomy. And they're basically immobilizing you. That's what they do. So then this is what's really cool.
Yeah.
They have a trick that honeybees live through the winter. And just like us, they can warm their bodies. And that's the key, because they have control over their ability to make heat. And so they can actually withstand quite a high temperature, about 4 degrees higher than the hornet can, because you get high enough temperature and you'll die.
Yeah.
And so they now surrounded this thing in this very dense ball. It's about a tennis ball-sized batch of bees. There's a lot of them, hundreds of them there. And they start cooking this hornet. And, of course, the hornet will die 4 degrees below them. And so they are still alive. They maybe are uncomfortable. Who knows? I don't know how you ask a honeybee if it's uncomfortably hot.
Yeah.
But they're alive. And the last trick that they do is, it turns out when you live in a dense environment like they do and you have to keep all that heat, you don't have much ventilation. It's kind of like living in Utah in the winter and having your doors wide open. You're going to have an awfully high heating bill and you're going to be cold. So they cluster together, close everything. What that means is all that metabolic energy that they were chewing up of sugars turns into carbon dioxide. And the carbon dioxide, then they can withstand that because that's the environment that they're normally, you know, living in the winter. So they have a tolerance for high carbon dioxide. But the hornet doesn't. And so they not only cook the hornet, they poison it with carbon dioxide. And when the hornet is dead, they just all release it and drag it off the edge of the hive and just dump it there, and that's the end of the hornet.
Justin Schmidt is with us. His book is called The Sting of the Wild. We will take more of your questions and talk a little bit more when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Justin Schmidt. We're talking about his book, The Sting of the Wild. I received an email earlier today, this morning, from Brandon, who had this question that I've always had. He was wondering why it is that a honeybee, when she stings, loses her stinger and then dies. Why is that? How does that make sense in a sort of biological, evolutionary? Because then she dies. Why would she do that? How does that work?
Yeah, that's one of the big, big questions in evolutionary biology. It was something that Darwin grappled with back in the mid-1800s. He was trying to say, you know, all my ideas of natural selection, how do I explain the honeybee dying and losing its sting? You know, how does that help the honeybee? And he, unbeknownst to him at the time, you know, genetics wasn't known. So Mendel had been about the same time, but he hadn't actually been aware of Mendel's work. It was kind of in obscure places of the genetics. So we didn't know how we were related in families. But he said, well, the only thing I can explain is that maybe if by helping your close relatives, you know, your brothers and sisters, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, and so on, and helping them survive, then maybe my family lineage will benefit by my sacrifice. And so it turned out that he was completely right. How it works with the honeybees is you have the queen, and there's only one queen in a colony, and she does all the egg laying, or essentially all the egg laying. And then a whole bunch of her workers, 10, 20, 30, 40,000 of them, a lot of them, they don't do any reproducing directly. They reproduce and pass their genes because, of course, they're related to their mom. You know, they're the mom's daughter. Yeah. So, you know, of course, they're part of the family. And so they can help their family lineage by making sure mom stays alive. If mom dies, that's the end of our lineage. You know, we're it. We're done. And so it's very important to keep mom alive. I like being alive, of course, but I don't do any reproducing myself. So my lineage doesn't depend on me being alive. It depends on me providing food for the other individuals and protecting my queen. And so, of course, I do provide the food. That's why I go to flowers and get nectar and pollen. But by stinging, I can then protect the queen. And so that brings up the question, say, well, yeah, okay, fine. But paper wasps and most yellow jackets sting and they don't die.
Yeah.
So why don't you just do like a yellow jacket?
Yeah.
And the answer is that if you're a paper wasp and you only have 50 individuals in a colony or fewer, then each individual is worth a lot. You know, you lose one or two, and that impacts, you know, your ability to function. But a honeybee, you got 10, 20, 30,000. You lose one, you know, so what? No big deal.
Right.
So the cost of the colony is pretty trivial. And then you say, okay, well, now you're saying that I'm not worth anything, which is mostly true as far as defense of the colony. So why should I, if I'm not worth anything, lose my stinger as opposed to just, you know, having a stinger like, you know, a yellow jacket or paper wasp? And the answer there is that you're a big individual, and so you get on the lip of a bear or the nose of a beekeeper or, you know, somebody that's attacking them. And before you can get much venom into them, they've knocked you off or scratched you off. So you get, you know, small dose, 5, 10% of your venom in, and that's about it. You've lost the rest. But if you lose your stinger, they knock you off, and okay, we're smart enough to know and see that there's a stinger there, so we'll kind of scrape it out in most cases. But the bear doesn't know that, the raccoon doesn't know that, the honey badger doesn't know that, the other predators that did get stung by bees to try to eat them don't know that. And so they think, oh, problem solved. You know, bee is gone. Well, wrong, because the venom keeps operating. It's its own little, almost like a little microorganism itself. It has a little nerve center there. We call it a nerve ganglion. And it controls the muscles, which not only drive the stinger deeper and deeper, but it also controls the venom delivery. So you get the whole wad of venom in there. And the advantage besides getting all the venom in is that it also flags it with this odor. It smells kind of like a cross between fingernail polish and an overripe banana. And this then alerts the sisters to this flag, this stinger that you've lost is saying, here's a vulnerable spot. Here's a chunk where you can get through all those armor of fur, feathers, scales, or whatever is protecting the vulnerable.
Yeah.
Yeah, come here, because this is where it works. This is where you can do the trick.
I read something. Somebody had said that despite all of that, honeybees will try to unscrew themselves when they sting.
Yeah,
that
was a Japanese worker way back. Oh, I think it was in the 50s or 60s. And it was with the Japanese honeybees that he was working, the ones that we talked about with the hornet a little earlier.
Yeah.
And sometimes they will, I don't know if I should use the word mistakenly, but let's just use that for sake of argument. They sting when they realize, oh, I didn't really need to sting. That was a mistake. Well, then why should I give up my life? I'm being anthropomorphic here, but sure, I think that makes it so we can understand, you know, what's going on a little bit easier. You know, why lose my life for no good reason? This thing doesn't need to be, you know, get the full dose of venom. So they'll kind of go like a reverse corkscrew, you know, is you screw a corkscrew into a wine bottle, pull out the cork. Well, then if you had that stuck on your corkscrew forever and ever, you know, you'd use it once and you'd throw the thing away. You'd be essentially dead. And so it unwinds the corkscrew, so to speak, and it goes around and round and round. Sometimes it takes 3 or 4 minutes, you know, a long time going around till it can finally work its way and get the stinger out, which is kind of clever. That shows that the bee has the ability to make a decision. Is it worth dying or is it not?
Yeah.
In this case, it's not worth dying.
Right. Let me ask you, we're essentially out of time, but I wanted to, you've got a whole section where you write about pain, the psychology of pain, how sometimes pain is a lie, how insects are good at exploiting pain. Did you say something finally about what you've learned getting stung so much about pain?
Well, I've learned that pain is a beautiful system for what I call mimicry or bluffing. That if you can use pain, you can make your life a whole lot better. That is, you being the insect, of course, not, you know, you being the target. If you're the target, you know, it's the opposite way around. But pain is a wonderful way to neutralize the advantage that a very big insect, a very big animal has over a small one. You say with us, and, you know, if we were being charged by an elephant, you know, wow, you know, we don't have any defense against a charging elephant, except, you know, now we invented rifles and firearms so we could shoot the elephant, which makes us equal to the elephant or actually even stronger than the elephant. Well, the insects, the same thing. Pain is kind of like an insect gun where it can neutralize and get through the armor of a much, much bigger animal like you or me, for example,
right,
and get the message across, leave me alone.
Justin Schmidt, his book is The Sting of the Wild. Joined us from the studios of Arizona Public Media in Tucson. Justin, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you also.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.